Hi, I'm Sharon Sneer. You're listening to Grief's Gift, a podcast that explores stories of loss and grief and how and where to find within these painful times some of life's most beautiful gifts. We all have the freedom to make choices out of the losses we experience. Courageous, creative, collaborative, and conscious choices that so often become the gifts we hold most dear. So welcome to the conversations, meditations, and connections that are grief's gift. It is such a great pleasure today to introduce my guest, Helena Amiason. Helena comes from a culturally and linguistically diverse background. She was born in Krakow in Poland and immigrated to Australia with her family in 1960 to escape the resurgence of anti-Semitism in Eastern Europe. She won literature prizes for poetry and writing in high school and attracted to exotic lands and cultures, she began diarizing her adventures in her teens. She trekked solo through Southeast Asia, across the United States, and Canada to the edge of the Alaskan tundra in the winter of 1975. In Australia, Helena practiced as a speech pathologist in human communication disorders, specializing in voice as well as voice over for ABC and SBS television, acting in films and theater, and presenting reviews on 2SERFM. In 1981, on a one-year trip around the world, she met her future husband, a much older Muslim Egyptian man who changed the trajectory of her life. Forging a strong and lasting bond, they married and moved to Alexandria in Egypt, where she lived from 1985 to 2002. After her husband's untimely death in Malawi in 2002, she returned with her two children to Australia. It is such a pleasure to have Helena here today. There is so much more that we're going to discuss in this conversation, and I welcome you to Grief's Gift.
Thank you.
Helena, I have been reading through your bio, and there's just so much in it, and you have done so much in your life. But I guess what I'd like to start with is what you're ending up with at this point in your life, which is the book you've been writing and the book that I understand is going to be published by the end of this year.
We hope.
We hope.
On these things take, you know, but that's the plan.
Yeah. So can you tell me a little bit about it? I'd love to hear about that book.
Sure. It's actually pretty much the story of how my late husband and I met, literally in Asian heaven, halfway between Hong Kong and Taiwan, 5 days into my 1 year abroad. I'd taken a sabbatical from my speech pathology work. I needed to get away to meet with relatives that I hadn't met before in my past, and family that was left in Russia, and colleagues around the world that were working in different countries. And I thought, this is the time. And 5 days into that 1 year abroad, as I mentioned, I met my late husband literally in heaven, on the plane in heaven. And he pursued me around the planet while he was an international businessman, and he pursued me around the world while I was doing my trip. And the interest point here being that we couldn't be more different. I was 26 at the time. I was a Western woman, an Australian of Polish Russian descent and Jewish. And my late husband was Egyptian, Muslim, 17 years my senior. You name it, we had every obstacle that could possibly be imagined between us. So, you know, interfaith, cross-cultural, social, age gap, you know, just generational difference. Yet there was something that connected us, and both of us knew immediately. And so it's the story of this incredible journey on multiple levels. My own personal journey when I traveled around the world, my own personal pilgrimage. I was on my own spiritual path. I sat Zazen in Japan. I did, you know, it was a kind of a pilgrimage of my own into back into my roots, connecting up with people professionally, socially, whatever. And then as well, I got an insight, a window into the world of international businessmen and how they conduct business, particularly in the Far East, which was his area of expertise. So there were these dual sort of ways of traveling, my own sort of slightly more low-key way, which offered its own gifts and experiences, of course, that he couldn't have. And then he showed me another side of life that I normally wouldn't have seen or had the, you know, opportunity to have a look into that world, the five-star world, the executive suites, the nature of negotiations and big business and all that, which was fascinating for me as well. And so there's these two threads. Meanwhile, constantly I have this conflict between my heart and my head. My logic and my mind tell me, where can this possibly go? What is this? Is it just a, you know, holiday romance, or is it a fling? And yet deep down inside, in my soul and in my heart, I knew that this was a very serious and deep connection, as did he. It is a happy, has a happy ending. And right. We, of course, do get together and prove that all obstacles can be overcome, you know, with a certain, love is not just enough, you know, love is the foundation upon which you then have to have mutual respect and tolerance and understanding, and it is possible. It is possible for people to coexist and coexist in harmony and with love. You know, it's we our relationship was a testament to that.
Yes. Yeah. You know, I think of you as a 26-year-old, and I'm wondering whether at 26 there was a part of you that could throw caution to the wind and go along with something that had no rhyme or reason, but you just were willing to explore and, you know, be present in the present moment with him.
Very true. I think being abroad helped in that. I had that cloak of anonymity that you have. You know, I've always been a solo traveler. I've always trekked alone until I met him. And then still when we weren't together, we had this series of rendezvous because of the nature of his work. He was able to come and meet up with me across the globe in different locations. But the rest of the time I was back on my own again. And so I think that sort of allowed me to be my own person. But when I finally came back to Australia, yes, exactly, I had to make that decision. There is a period where we break up, actually 17 months, 1 year and 5 months, to give another life a chance, thinking to myself, well, look, if I can find someone that could make my parents happy as well as myself, why not? Maybe this is the universe telling me this is all in the too hard basket, and I gave that a go. But when we meet up again, I have to make the decision that I have to follow my own destiny and whatever, sorry for all the cliches, but you know, when you make your bed, you have to sleep in it. I knew all the potential problems. I'd had them pointed out to me 10 million times over by my father. We all aware of what can happen in Islam. We hear about it so often, all the negative things that can happen. They can marry four women. You know, he'll bring another woman to the bed. If the relationship sours, he can take the children or keep the children. All these things, I was aware of that. But at some point in time, having tried to put him out of my life and out of my heart and out of my mind, when we met up again, that reunion was so powerful that I recognized that I could no longer deny my own destiny. And whatever risk I was taking, I was willing to do it because I would never be, I would feel that I would go to my grave never feeling that I had lived my authentic life and tried to follow my own path, not the design that my parents may have had in their mind for me. And I appreciated their concern. And they also had concern for themselves. And they had concern for me and the dangers of what is a young Jewish woman, a Western woman, what's her life going to be like if she's living in a predominantly Muslim country in Egypt, in the Middle East? You know, are there going to be snipers on the roof? How will they treat her? What will her life be like? So they were concerned for me as well as they were concerned for themselves. They were concerned that the community would turn their backs on them. And what would the reaction be? And what would the neighbors think? And what would the Josenbergs say? Because they weren't the Joneses. So, you know, there are all these things playing into it. But in the end, I had to decide that I really had to follow my own life's path. And fortunately for me, I had made the right choice. As difficult as it was, and the obstacles and challenges, of course, that we inevitably had, there was something in the strength of our connection that we felt we can overcome those challenges. And we proved that we could, and we did.
Yes. And overcoming challenges is probably a legacy that your parents left you, because they overcame incredible challenges, did they not?
Absolutely, absolutely. I think, you know, our parents were of that Holocaust generation that were survivors. Even though my father actually left Poland and went to Russia, where he met my mum in Uzbekistan. She's actually from Uzbekistan in the old, you know, Soviet Republic. And so he actually left Europe and wasn't part of the Holocaust experience per se. And yet it impacted on him there. He was actually incarcerated, beaten and tortured. My mother was living in a predominantly Islamic Uzbekistan that at that time was under communist rule back in 1981. So nonetheless, my parents survived and were resilient. They returned. My dad took my mum back to Poland to see who of his family were left, because this information was coming back. And basically, my father had lost most of his relatives, most of his family had been annihilated, gassed in the, you know, in Auschwitz and, you know, in Poland. And the only few relatives that remained because they were on Schindler's List and had been taken out of Auschwitz to Czechoslovakia and then were later brought back. So I've got a very small portion. My aunt from Melbourne and my cousins there all survived because they were actually on Schindler's List. My mum too, having survived, you know, getting out of Russia, and that the regime there had worked for her in her field. She was a conservatorium musical professor. And that shows one positive aspect of communism for her, in that life was poor, but they had education, free schooling. She had actually benefited from that. But then they were, you know, under communist rule in Poland. So everything had to be undercover. The fact that they were Jewish, the fact that they were trying to do business, which was actually not acceptable. You know, in those days, you had to be equally poor like everybody else. And my father was a capitalist. He wanted to earn and be remunerated for his work. That all had to be hidden. So there was incredible stress and pressure. Finally, they came to Australia. As immigrants, we were able to bring a lot of our things with us. We weren't like refugees. My father managed to bribe a few people in high positions, and they were offering visas at that time in 1959. We arrived in Australia in 1960. And my dad had brought his money with him and all his goods, but he was ripped off by a pair of Jewish people that took advantage of him in the slump of 62, in the real estate business that he went into, and was robbed of all his cash. He had to start from scratch, right from scratch, including my mother to help him with, you know, doing gluing vinyl handbags, you know, and the vinyl onto the handles, and then, you know, peddling French imported, you know, wholesale bonboni, you know, chocolates and this kind of thing until he got into business. And then they managed to claw their way up back into a good standard of life here in Australia. So there was resilience and resilience all the way. And my husband had experienced similar hardships with his family in Egypt, because even though they were Muslim and Egyptian, when Nasser came into power and nationalized the country, his family also were in a private business. His father was father of artillery in Egypt, so he'd been engaged in the army. But then he went into business. He was a hotelier and in the textiles, like my own father. His partner was a Ladino Jew. I learned all this incredible stuff about life in Egypt, you know, in the 50s and 60s, before my time when I went there in the 80s. And there was this convivencia, this conviviality between all the religions, Muslims and Christians, or Christian Copts, and Jews and Greeks, and the whole community was so cosmopolitan. And when Nasser nationalized, he took away everything of his own people, of Muslims and Egyptians, as well as he kicked out all the foreigners, but he nationalized them as well. So they lost their villa, their car, everything was just bought off for £5 here and £2 there. So he had to start again. They had to start again. So I guess we had similar sort of life experiences, that even with this actual big age gap, 17 years he was my senior, it actually bonded us, because he grew up in the pre-Islamic Alexandria, which was very, very cosmopolitan. And their lifestyle was very, very European before the more regimented Islamic sort of blinkered life occurred later on. So he had actually grown up in a world that was akin and open to the kind of social world that I had had. And that's, I guess, where we connected again. So, yeah, resilience and fortitude against, you know, enduring all these obstacles. Absolutely.
It's very poignant for you to bring up the values and the virtues of moving through loss and grief. And what I'm hearing is that both your parents and your late husband were able to bring in those qualities that they had developed through prior losses in order to succeed and flourish in their lives. You were married for how many years?
18 years. We had like a 21-year relationship, because we met in 81 and he passed away in 2002. And I must mention something very beautiful. On my wedding ring, on the inside of it, he actually, because we actually ended up, because of all the difficulties and me really having a good long hard think about it and then breaking up with him and then getting ultimately back, it was like 4 years down the track after we had first met in my overseas trip, year-long trip around the world, that we actually got married in 85. But on my ring, the day we met, and I will never forget it because it was actually my mother's birthday, was the 5th of May. So it was the 5th of the 5th, 1981. And that's the date that he inscribed on my wedding ring, because for him, the day we met, the moment we met, was the time we began our life together. And I thought that that was really very beautiful, and that's still on my wedding ring. So yeah, I consider it a 21-year relationship, even though we're actually technically married for a little less than that. But our relationship continued, you know, over that length of time. Very beautiful. And then he passed away, unfortunately, unexpectedly, from a heart attack in Malawi, in Blantyre. At that time, he was the honorary vice consul for South Africa. The South African consulate in Alexandria had sent him on just a small reconnaissance trip to Malawi to see if they could tie up some business. They have tea plantations in Malawi. They have coffee, teak wood, tobacco. And my husband was sent, you know, on this kind of a mission. He was only meant to be away 10 days. I didn't accompany him on every short business trip. You know, I had the children, and I was working at the American Center, teaching English at that time, working in that kind of related field. I wasn't really doing speech pathology by that stage in Egypt. And I got a call, you know, and between classes, I was about to go into class at the American Center, and the Egyptian embassy in Malawi informed me that my husband had just passed away. And so I knew at that moment that my life would irrevocably be changed forever. I had two children, my children, a girl and a boy. My daughter was not yet 16, sweet 16. My son was bar mitzvah age 13, which we didn't do in Egypt at that time. He turned 13 in December, and then in 2002, January, just weeks later, my husband suddenly passed away. And so it was just an extraordinary moment. You know, it's like a complete 180, if not 360. So you know your life is never going to be the same again. You know, we were really a very, very successful, what you'd call a successful, happy, passionate marriage right until his final day. We cooperated, we worked well together, we had a good delineation of roles that were perhaps a little traditional in some ways, also perhaps because also I was actually living in Egypt, but my husband was always also a very open-minded modern thinker as well. Mm. So we kind of navigated that way between tradition, you know, and modern cooperation. It was very difficult for me because I knew that having lived all those years by then in Egypt, 18 years virtually in Egypt, I knew that the man, no matter how intelligent the woman is and how capable and whether she's a lawyer or a engineer or whatever, in the end, they deal with the man. They refer, if there's tradespeople or engineers or whatever, even though I'm actually managing all that business, for example, our villa, we were building a villa and, you know, I was like basically hands-on with all the designing and with the actual workmen and the architects and all that. When it came down to business and somebody, a higher-up tradesperson or you know, manager or something of some nature would come and speak, they'd speak to my husband, even though I was doing all the business. So I knew I had lost my rock, my, you know, the person that they were always had dealt with when it came to the finances, whatever. It was like I became invisible and they dealt with him. And I thought, suddenly all of this now is on my back in Arabic, in a foreign language. And I could speak by then quite sort of adequately to manage those sorts of things. But I couldn't read and write very well. So I would need someone who I could trust who could then start to translate all those documents. You know, I had to think about what am I going to do in my life now? My world in Egypt was associated with him. I couldn't see a future for myself. It was becoming more and more Islamic. Extremist Islam was taking over. The country was becoming more fundamentalist. The economy was going down the drain. And I thought, what future is there here for me now with my children, young children looking towards tertiary education in their near future? What do I do now? I knew that without him, I wasn't yet 50. I was, this was such a shock to me. I had never expected to be a single mother with teenage children. And I hadn't wanted to be. We had a very happy marriage, you know. Suddenly now I was forced to come up like with a new life.
Hi, this is Sharon Sneer and you're listening to Grief's Gift. If you resonate with what you're hearing, please don't forget to let your friends and family know. And if you have your own experience that you would like to share, please contact me on www.sharonsneer.com or on my email, sharon@sharonsneer.com. Thank you so much for listening to Grief's Gift. It sounds like you didn't really have time to grieve. With all of what you have to do, I can't hear from you whether there was space in your life.
No, you're spot on, exactly. What helped me get through that early time, I think, was the fact that I had to be so busy. First of all, I had children I had to look after. They were in school. Their life had to continue. Second of all, we were in the final stages of completion of the villa. I couldn't just drop all that. I still had to maintain it. Third of all, my husband's position as honorary vice consul of the South African consulate was passed on to me by the South African ambassador. So I then actually took over his business, you know, honorary position there, not having a clue really what I was doing, but having, I think, good social skills and confidence in that sort of a PR position, I managed to somehow muddle my way through it. By the way, I still was teaching at the American Center of Alexandria. It used to be called the American Cultural Center. I still had classes that I couldn't automatically drop until I found substitutes. I had like four things on the go at that time. I had the most incredible family. My late husband's family are my family. My in-laws supported me through this period. My sister-in-law from Amman, Jordan, came to stay with me at the early stages because, you know, Islam is very similar to Judaism. We also have this sort of a concept of sitting a Shiva in Islam, a lot of which their religion is based upon. You know,
so a Shiva, sitting Shiva, for those that don't know, is sitting for the 7 days following the death of a family member, usually a husband or a wife or a parent, and allowing that time to be cared for and looked after by family and friends. So you don't traditionally cook, you don't even wash unless it's before the Sabbath, and you allow yourself to be looked after and to deeply grieve during those 7 days.
In Islam, it's 4 days and it's called Azza, and there's a gender split. The men took my son to the mosque. I had a lot of support in those few days where literally his family carried me on their hands. You know, and then, boom, it was back into the realities of life and what I needed to cope with. So I really didn't have time to focus on my own grieving because I had to be busy, busy, busy. And it was a way of pushing it aside. And when I returned to Australia with the children the following year to start my life again in Australia, don't forget, I was then sandwiched between two generations. A generation above me, my aging, ailing, fragile parents who were in their late 80s, and my teenage children who had to start a new life in Australia. So I didn't even have a chance to grieve them because my parents couldn't bear to see me in such pain. It killed them to see me in grief as a young widow, not even 50 yet, having lost my husband. And he was only 64 when he passed away. So it was a tragedy all round. And yet you're right, I didn't have that chance to grieve. I needed to be stoic like the children were. The children themselves were very stoic, and I needed to protect my parents from worrying about me. So it was only in private that I could grieve. And it's taken me years, I think, to write this book because somehow it was a way of, I think, hanging on to him and that relationship, keeping it alive in my life. And it wasn't until I discovered some very good groups that I could go to with people who didn't know me, again, with this anonymity where you can bare your soul and show your grief without people who are burdened by it because they're not emotionally connected to you because they don't know you. And that's where you get the help and the assistance, where you learn that the grief itself won't consume you. I felt that it was so overwhelming. I could go into a corner and just lose myself in there. But I had a responsibility to my parents. I had a responsibility to my children. And I knew I had to go on. And I guess what grief's gift to me was then that I could do it. I could prove to my children that there is a life after death. And I guess I wanted to be that, what can I say, that model or role model for him, that this is a part of life and we have to learn to deal with it. And we can survive. We will cope. We will overcome, you know, all our obstacles as it is. We will miss him. We will revere his memory. We will honor his memory, as I learned to do in Egypt with my late husband's family and with my own family in Australia. And we keep their lessons alive within us and hope that their wisdom stays with us and guides us through it. But really, we need to be resilient. And knowing that my husband valued and admired and respected all my capabilities and my strengths helped to strengthen me, I think, to know that he would be proud to know that even though he left me, he's not with me only, maybe in spirit, and that I have to go forge this journey on my own and doing all that stage of life. Something within me lives in me that is a part of having known him and being with him, and that strengthens me, I think. Otherwise, I don't know how I do it. And having my own spiritual path, I guess, having always meditated and, you know, done my yoga and done my growth groups and all of this, always maintaining that as a kind of a foundation in helping me go forward. I think all those things, that they are the only gifts of grief that I can see, that life is a blessing and that I would dishonor his memory if I didn't take the best of what we forged together as a couple into my life now without him, as much as it will forever be painful that I didn't have more time with him, you know?
Is there any part of you that you recognize now that emerged directly out of the loss of your late husband?
I suppose the opportunity to find my writing voice and have that time to myself. Inevitably, no matter how much you can say your husband allows you your own space and all that, you know what it's like as a mother and a wife. And, there are so many responsibilities that often we allow parts of our creative side to a little bit be on the back burner. I discovered that even after he passed away and I was in relationships, that inevitably we would travel or whatever and my writing would go on the back burner. My life was involved with a relationship at that time. And I think now I see that I kind of own my own space and my own life and my own, future, and that I've been able to really bring this story forward now that he always felt was of value to the world, to know. It's a message of hope, really, and a message of, reconciliation and that we can exist in a it's a good story. It's a good story that people need to hear because so much is about war and what divides us, not what unites us. And I think he always said to me, you need to write this story. He was always really aware of it, that we had a story that was worthy of, a greater readership because it crosses from the individual and the personal to the universal. It crosses that bridge because everyone will have had at least one of our challenges. We had the lot, but at least you'll have either it'll be of a different race or you might be of a different religion or you might be of a different culture or you might be of, have that age gap or it might be a gender issue. It may be anything. Some people will be able to relate to some element of our struggles and our obstacles. And I think the gift for me is that I can now encapsulate all the journey that we lived and succeeded in, and triumphed over those obstacles. I think it's a very powerful story, and I think that's the legacy that kind of, in a way, that he's left me with. Mm-hmm. My challenge.
Just to finish up, I think it would be useful to just touch on your children. Because as strong and as busy and as occupied and supported you were, I'm wondering how you supported your children who suddenly were told your father isn't coming home.
Oh, that's a tricky one, Sharon. It's a difficult area. When you yourself are a grieving parent, I was a grieving widow. I had lost my soulmate. I had lost the love of my life. And I think I was, in a way, although I was busy and active doing all the stuff I needed to do, maybe now I query whether I had supported in particular my son as much as perhaps I needed to. I didn't realize at that time. I saw the acting out behavior, but I didn't recognize that there was perhaps more that I needed to do or more that I could have done. But I know that he went through a very difficult healing process because he had this idealized image of his father. And I think it was a wrench because I literally deracinated the children out of a predominantly Muslim society to Australia and to a Jewish community at 13, my son, after September 11th. So it was a very, very tricky time where I think there was a lot of identity fracture for him. And then he joined the army. So I think he's got, the PTSD that comes along with the trauma of having done a tour of Afghanistan and all that. I think there were issues. My daughter was 16, and I think it's different for a girl. She had her mum. A girl has her mum, it's different. For a boy on the cusp of puberty to lose their father, especially a man who was larger than life, highly respected, well-established businessman and well-liked person in his community, it was huge. And I think he suffered a lot, and I think he's still dealing with the fallout of that. Tricky. You can only do the best you can do, and forgive yourself for whatever, besides whatever they might have been, I don't know. I had helped myself, but no, they just went about their business and went to school and did their stuff. But I did see a lot of acting out behaviour in my son. Now I had a difficult teenagehood with him. And it's a lifelong process.
Mm.
As a counsellor said to me, he said, when somebody dies, that's not the end of a relationship. That's the beginning of a new relationship. The love doesn't die. The love stays with you forever. That was momentous to me. I thought, yes, yes, you understand. It's not like the person dies, boom, that's the end of the story. That's just the beginning mm-hmm. of a whole new life.
Yes, beautiful.
Physical presence. You know, that was very powerful to me. And that's what it is. It's learning to walk that journey with everything that you're left with. We'll deal with it. We will deal with it forever. I don't think you ever really get over it. There's nothing to get over. It was a reality. I'm not in denial. It's not like it never existed. And I don't want to be in denial about what we have. I want to keep it alive because I think it's an honouring of the memory and I think I try to keep that alive in my kids as well. We often speak of him and speak of his way with people and his jokes and his intellect and his wisdom, and I try to keep that, and the legacy that he left behind for us, you know, still serves us to this day. So yeah, he was a great man. So a great man, a great loss, you know, and that has its, impact, I think, on the children, as I said.
Thanks, Alina. Thank you so much for this. Lots to consider, lots to hear, lots of stories. I really appreciate the time you've given us to share your story and how you came and are still coming through the journey.
Thanks, Sharon, for giving me that opportunity. It's absolutely fabulous. Thank you so much.